Welcome to Beat Infertility, a podcast where we get real about infertility, empower you to take back control, and provide you with hope for the future. Ready? Here's your host, fellow infertility warrior, Heather Hooman.
Welcome to bonus episode 252. Today's guest is Dr. Allison Rogers, who is board certified in both obstetrics and gynecology and reproductive endocrinology and infertility. She currently practices at the Fertility Centers of Illinois, which you can find online at www.fcionline.com. After Dr. Rogers answers a few listener questions, we discuss ways to improve your fertility while taking a break. If you have a fertility question you'd like Dr. Rogers to answer in an upcoming episode, go to beatinfertility.co/ask. And if you'd like to speak to Dr. Rogers directly for a second opinion via Skype, contact her office at 877-324-4483. Don't forget to visit our website for more information about this episode at beatinfertility.co/bonus252. Take a listen. Hi, Dr. Rogers. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Heather.
We are going to start, as always, with some listener questions. The first one is from Jocelyn. She says, I am 31 and my husband is 38. Can certain protocols negatively affect egg quality? And if so, how does your physician know what will or won't work for you the next round of IVF?
So this is a great question. Remember, egg quality is something that's sort of inherent in your body. And anything we do to sort of improve egg quality is really just to support the growth of healthy eggs. Any supplements or medications can't give you healthy eggs. It's mainly to support the growth of those healthy eggs. So there's no protocols that can really negatively affect egg quality, but there are some protocols that people do better or worse on. That is a very different topic. And I think that's probably what you're trying to ask. And the question is sort of, how does your physician know what protocol is best for you? This is sort of the art of the science. And clearly every doctor has a little bit of a different practicing style. Certainly there are some medications that are better for certain types of patients, maybe PCOS or diminished reserve, but this is very different for every doctor. So it's important you talk to your doctor and ask sort of why they thought this protocol would be the best for you.
Just a quick question of my own. I had a coaching client the other day who had a consult with a new doctor, and the doctor told her that there is no difference in response across protocols. And so he always does the same protocol for every patient. I'd love to hear your response to that situation.
So I don't agree with that. I will say that you could give the same patient the same protocol 3 months in a row and they're going to do different, mainly because we have a human body. We're not a computer. So the input, same input does not equal same output. So every cycle is a little bit different, but I don't agree with that at all, respectfully.
I had a feeling you wouldn't, but I wanted to throw it out there so people know, right?
Yeah.
The next question is from Jessica. She says, I am 32. My husband is 34. I have unexplained infertility and recently experienced a miscarriage at 12 weeks after my first round of IVF. We tested after the DNC and everything came back normal, which is heartbreaking. We ran a recurrent loss panel that also came back normal. I'm feeling lost about what we should do next. It feels like we should be doing additional testing just to rule out other issues.
A couple things. One is when we think about testing, are they doing just pathology testing? Are they doing genetic testing? And if they're doing genetic testing, are they doing the type of testing that can rule out maternal cell contamination? Because with a DNC, a lot of the cells that are collected are actually just your cells. And so if we get a result back that's 46XX, that's probably your DNA and not fetal DNA. So we certainly see a lot of error in that testing. There are some tests that can look at maternal cell contamination and tell you if it's been ruled out. So that's something I would look at. The other thing is that there's lots of reasons to have miscarriages. Certainly there's a lot of anatomic problems that can happen in an embryo or baby, so that the baby, maybe the heart or the brain or something else just wasn't developing correctly, that was not compatible with life. So I certainly would recommend you try again. For patients who've had losses like this, sometimes we'll recommend pre-implantation genetic testing just to try to avoid any other losses.
a couple of follow-ups of my own. Jessica didn't mention whether or not she had PGT, so it's hard to tell exactly what her situation was. She also didn't say whether or not the transfer was fresh or frozen, so a couple of different questions there. But I wanted to know how accurate the testing after a DNC is, because you were talking about how sometimes you can get the maternal products.
So I think it really depends on the individual case and the exact tests that are being done. So certainly the more fetal tissue it is there, the further along you are, the more chance they have of catching the fetal DNA. Also, certainly if you have a test that can rule out maternal contamination, then you know for sure if it's maternal or fetal cells. So not all hospitals or doctors offer this. So something to find out for sure.
The next question is from Ryan. She says, I am 35 and my husband is 32. We have been trying for years with no success. On our third IUI, we became pregnant. I'm only 6 weeks right now, but we have a subchorionic hematoma. This happened last time I was pregnant, but I miscarried. I was put on Lovenox once we became pregnant this time. My doctor currently wants us to continue the Lovenox and reevaluate in a week. Can you explain this condition? Why it keeps happening, what your protocol would be, and if you'd continue the Lovenox in this case.
So clearly, I would encourage Ryan to sort of listen to her doctor's recommendations. The doctor she's working with probably knows her case best. Clearly, there's a lot more that we can look at and test. In general, subchorionic hematomas are sort of blood clots next to the placenta, and they occur because the placenta has to sort of invade into the uterus. And as it does that, it sometimes hits a blood vessel as the mother's circulation is connecting with baby circulation, and there can be some bleeding. So this happens. I would say at least 50% or more of pregnancies have this, and it's very, very common. Now, Lovenox or baby aspirin is not going to cause a bleed, but if you do bleed, it will make it worse. So it's all about risks and benefits. Typically, in my patients who have subchorionic hematomas, I recommend they consider stopping Lovenox or blood thinners. In my opinion, if it was just a subchorionic hematoma, I would probably have this patient stop those. But maybe there's something more going on in this particular case.
I was going to add that I got subchorionic hematomas for all of my pregnancies as well. And I was always taken off Lovenox when that happened.
Yeah, so maybe there's something else going on here we're not aware of.
So is there anything else she should be doing?
There's not much she can do to control it, right? So she can obviously take it easy when she's at home, avoid strenuous exercise, avoid lifting heavy things, avoid intercourse, just some general precautions.
The next question is from Katie. She says, I am 37 and my husband is 36. We have been trying to conceive for 2 years after receiving a diagnosis of diminished ovarian reserve at 35. I had one spontaneous pregnancy that ended in a miscarriage due to trisomy 22. I discovered 6 months into my trying to conceive journey that I also have unicornuate uterus. I had a non-communicating rudimentary horn with endometrium, as well as stage 1 endometriosis, both removed surgically 9 months ago. Over the past year, we have had 3 mini IVF retrieval cycles, which produced 8 blastocysts, 4 of which were normal. In an ideal world, we would love to have 2 babies. I have requested ERA testing, even though I have not tried a transfer yet. My 2 questions. First one is, my RE does not do a mock transfer as a standard protocol. Is this something I should request? Would you want to do a mock transfer prior to an FET in a patient with this type of uterine anomaly? And 2, is there any additional testing you would do prior to a transfer in a situation like this?
I think that most people do not do mock transfers anymore. That's something that we did a lot before we were using ultrasound guidance. Now that we do use ultrasound guidance, we don't really do that. And when I do a saline sonogram on a patient, that's more or less like a mock transfer. The idea of a mock transfer is just to make sure you can get the catheter in. And if she has a unicornuate uterus, you know which way it is, either left or right. And you usually can get your catheter and it's not a problem. In terms of additional testing with a unicornuate uterus, now there's not any published data on this, but I will say, like, I have a good number of patients with unicornuate uteruses, and they all seem to have uterine issues with uterine window of implantation. And So I personally would recommend considering an ERA. Now, if you have four embryos and you want two kids, you could do a transfer first. And then if you're successful, great. And if you're not successful, then consider an ERA. That's probably what I would do.
The next question is from Sandra. She says, I am 30 and my husband is 31. I would like to hear your opinion about sperm DNA fragmentation. My husband had a very good semen analysis with only morphology being low. Because he had very high count and good motility, our doctor wasn't worried. But he recently had a DNA fragmentation result at 35%. We have been trying to conceive for more than 2 years and had three losses. Can DNA fragmentation be one of the factors causing infertility, and can it increase the risk of miscarriage? Are there things that can be done to help with DNA fragmentation? Do you have patients who are successful despite having this problem? We've had many interventions before he was tested for DNA fragmentation. Do you think this test will become more common in the future? And do you think it is useful information to have before starting treatment? Does knowing a couple has high DNA fragmentation change your approach?
So these are great questions. First question is, can DNA fragmentation be a factor with fertility? It potentially can. And what they do is they do a semen analysis test to see sort of how tightly woven the sperm DNA is. And if it's really fragmented or has a higher percentage, then it may lead to not getting pregnant or abnormal pregnancies. The question is this increasing the risk of miscarriage? Possibly, but likely not. Sounds like there's other female issues going on that could be a role of that. Are there things that can be done to help with DNA fragmentation? So I'll often recommend antioxidants to my patients, although this is not a test that's widely used, and it's been around a long, long time. I do not think it'll be increasing in value. It just has pretty little value from a fertility perspective, but typically would recommend things like lifestyle, so alcohol, caffeine, smoking, exposure to toxins, fish oil, and CoQ10 can be helpful. And the real reason to do this test is to decide whether you want to use donor sperm. If you're like, your husband has sperm or your partner has sperm and you want to use your partner's sperm and you're not interested in donor yet, then I don't know if this test has a whole lot of value. So I think the only change you could make if you want is to fertilize with donor sperm, or some patients will do some with donor sperm.
So if you are interested in donor sperm, I take it you do find this test useful. And can you tell us a little bit about the normal ranges and what's considered mild versus high? I don't think we've talked about this on the show before.
Yeah. So there's a couple different companies and every company has a little different values. So I don't want to give specific numbers because all the companies are a little bit different. And it's very vague. It's like normal. Almost all of my patients come back indeterminate. Almost everybody does, or severe. And, you know, if in a case where you're having failed, I would see it more with failed fertilization, maybe. But theoretically, ICSI should help that. And, you know, if somebody's changed their lifestyle and there's nothing else to change, the only real consideration is to consider donor sperm. So it's just not a super helpful test. I mean, we all know what we should be doing in terms of lifestyle. There's not like a magic medication. It's not like we can give a guy a certain medication to help with this.
How long should the guy be doing these lifestyle changes and perhaps something like CoQ10 before being tested again in hopes that things have been improved?
That is a great question. So I typically would say about 12 weeks.
This episode is sponsored by Mira, the only tracker that measures your actual fertility hormone concentrations and shows a unique hormone curve. The Mira Fertility Analyzer and app take the guesswork and stress out of ovulation tracking. I recently caught up with Sylvia Kang, co-founder and CEO of Mira, to ask her about at-home ovulation testing. What hormones are important to measure when tracking ovulation?
The most important hormones are luteinizing hormone, LH, estrogen hormone, and progesterone.
How can Mira be helpful during the coronavirus outbreak?
Mira is a fertility tracker that uses the same technology as how the blood work is done. So basically, during this challenging time, you don't have to go to a doctor's appointment and you can just use Mira to track fertility at home.
What is the next evolution of at-home ovulation testing?
So Mira will be the comprehensive women's testing platform. So we're launching the estrogen test in a couple of months. And in our future product line, we also have progesterone test and HCG testing for fetal growth.
Order a Mira starter kit online at miracare.com with the promo code BEATINFERTILITY and get $25 off. Now, back to the show. Let's move into the main topic of today, which is improving your fertility while on a break. As you and I discussed during our COVID-19 series, which listeners can find at beatinfertility.co/COVID-19, most fertility patients are currently on a forced break from treatments. But regardless of when someone is listening to this, let's talk about what they can do to improve their fertility while on a break, whether it's forced or not. The first one on my list is to get enough exercise, but not too much, and get enough sleep.
So this is a really important one. We know that people who don't get enough sleep have a hard time with their immune system. And certainly this is a time in life where we really, really need strong immune systems. And so I typically would recommend 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night for patients. Now, most of us with everything going on, sometimes it's hard to sleep because we have so much on our minds. One of the things that I'm recommending to my patients is to consider taking some melatonin. Melatonin is a hormone that helps with your circadian rhythm. It actually has been shown in some studies to help with egg quality as well. So it may be something you can consider. I typically recommend 3 milligrams before bed, and it may help you sort of ease off to sleep, turn your mind off a little. And we're going to talk about some other stress relievers that can help with sleep too. In terms of exercise, yes, sometimes when we're stressed, we tend to over-exercise. My recommendation and the recommendation is 150 minutes of moderate exercise or 75 minutes of strenuous exercise per week. You know, strenuous exercise is strenuous because you wouldn't be able to talk through it. So you'd be kind of panting and out of breath. So I think it's good to keep our bodies moving, make sure that even if we're stuck at home that or maybe not going to the gym, there's certainly other things we can do. We can walk, there's a bunch of boot camp kind of things. A lot of the gyms are doing online classes, internet classes. So you have to be a little creative. This is going to take a lot of work. And I think that with everybody's emotional state of mind, some people don't feel like exercising, but it's important to do a lot to sort of keep your body moving and keep your heart healthy.
I think I also saw you do a TikTok about strength training at home.
Yeah, so it's really important, and this is a little bit of a separate issue, right? But it's really important to not just focus on cardiovascular exercise. It's important also to think about strength training. And I have some people who've said to me, but I don't have any weights at home. I don't have a gym at home. Now listen, bags of sugar, canned goods, which we all have probably a lot of around now, you certainly can find other things to lift besides certified 3-pound weights or whatever. And I think there's a lot of exercises you can find on YouTube that can help strengthen your body. I think that if we think about sort of metabolism, the more muscle mass we have, the higher our metabolism is. So it is really important to combine cardiovascular exercise with strength training for everybody. The other thing is that it helps with bone health. We think about making sure our bones are healthy so we don't get osteoporosis later in life. And strength training is one, and weight bearing exercise is one of them.
The next tip is to eat better. So what should we be eating and what should we not be eating during this time?
So this is a little bit stressful because obviously there's not much in grocery stores. Some people have very limited choices. We're trying to minimize how much we're going to the store, eating a lot of processed and canned food. I was joking with my husband that we have some things in our pantry that I've never had before. My kids have never had Pop-Tarts before or Chef Boyardee. You know, those are things that are shelf stable and that we have in our pantry now. So I think it's really hard to always make good choices. We're in a, and not all of us, I'm in Illinois where we're in a shelter in place. You certainly can still go to the grocery store, but people are trying to really limit the number of times they're going to the grocery store. So obviously it's important to stay healthy. We may have a hard time right now getting healthy fruits and vegetables and limiting any processed foods. So the other thing it's important to think about, and I struggle with this also, is sort of stress eating. I think that a lot of us, when we're in these difficult, stressful situations, enjoy subconsciously and kind of need sometimes some dopamine hits from sweets and sugars. And we'll find ourselves sort of craving sugars or sweets or chocolates, ice creams, that kind of stuff. And even though it's a struggle and it helps us temporarily feel better, trying to maintain a healthy weight during this time, because it's so easy to just eat and eat and eat, is really something that we should focus on. And it's easier said than done, for sure. But if we're going to use this time as not like stopping treatment, but using this time, it's the way we're thinking about it. So using this time to prepare our body for the next cycle, we want to try to eat as healthy as we can. And even though we're all beyond stressed out and all super just stress eating and all the other things, it's really important to try to keep your goals in mind, because your goals are to prepare your body for pregnancy.
I don't know what it's like there in Illinois, but at least here in Maryland, all of our stores are out of fresh produce and meat. So it's really hard to be eating healthy right now, because there's just no access.
Yeah. So I would just encourage patients to do the best you can and be kind to yourself. Like, I know this isn't the way you're normally eating, but just be kind to yourself. And, you know, if you're eating higher fat, higher calorie dense foods, I should say, maybe you just eat a little bit less. And, you know, clearly things like Fitness Pal and other things can help you track the amounts. I would encourage people to weigh themselves just to sort of make sure they're staying on track. Because, and if you're somebody who's overweight, this is a really good time to try to help get your body healthier while you're in this sort of forced break. And trying to get your body healthier, if you're obese, is a really important thing to increase your chances. And it's so easy to stress eat. And obviously, there's a lot of reasons we all eat that are not for hunger. But I think that doing some serious work during this time of trying to just prepare your body for pregnancy, and you need to just talk to yourself about that, especially in those moments where your brain is saying, go get that other cookie. It's a horrible time. You deserve it. The thing is when we tell ourselves this, we deserve it, we're sort of rewarding ourselves with food, it's not really overall helping us with our goal of trying to be pregnant.
The next tip is to get enough vitamins. So I'd like to hear what vitamins are most important right now and the sources where we can get them.
Obviously, you should continue your prenatal vitamin, even if we're taking a break. The most important things in the prenatal vitamin, of course, are folic acid and iron. I also would encourage patients to take vitamin C. You can find this in oranges or orange juice, or you can have it sent to your house if you're trying to avoid going out. Vitamin C is really important. I think potatoes have vitamin C as well. Citrus food, even strawberries, if you can find them. But you can also buy a supplement that has it in there. A lot of people have been talking about elderberry. So elderberry is a supplement that is really good for influenza, but actually can be harmful if you have COVID. So I would recommend not taking elderberry.
What about vitamin D, especially since we aren't going outside anymore?
Absolutely. Calcium and vitamin D, especially if you're used to eating a lot of dairy and you're not getting to the store, being able to eat dairy, calcium and vitamin D is a great option. I like calcium citrate as opposed to calcium carbonate, because you can take it without food and you still absorb it. And for me, I get really sick from some vitamins. And if I take calcium carbonate, I like legit will not be able to tolerate it and they come right back. But calcium citrate, I'm able to even take it on an empty stomach and I do fine.
I've also been taking magnesium at night. It was recommended by a doctor a while ago for something totally different. But I feel like I remember that magnesium can also help relax you in the evening.
I'm not sure about the data on that one. I don't think people necessarily need a ton of magnesium. It can help with headaches and other things. But I think that the main ones to focus on are certainly calcium and vitamin D, folic acid, iron, and vitamin C.
Headaches are actually why I was prescribed it by my neurologist.
There you go.
The next one is limit caffeine intake, which I admit I am struggling with right now because I'm not sleeping well, like you mentioned earlier.
Yeah. So it's a little bit of a bad habit, like a bad cycle, right? We're not sleeping. We get up, we're tired. So we take caffeine. And sometimes that caffeine is stimulant and it can help us. But if we take it too late in the day, then it may also contribute to not being able to sleep at night. So from a fertility perspective, I would recommend no more than 300 milligrams. A can of soda has about 50 milligrams in it. An 8-ounce cup of coffee has about 100. I typically recommend, if you're drinking a coffee drinker, no more than 20 ounces of coffee. And I also recommend that patients don't drink caffeine after noon.
The next one is to quit smoking. Just a quick aside on this. Right before we started recording, I heard on the news that one of the essential businesses still open in California, which is also on shelter in place, is marijuana businesses. Is that something they should also be quitting as well during this time?
So I don't recommend smoking anything. If you feel like you have stress that's not manageable and you want and you feel like you need marijuana to help with stress management for the short term while you're taking a break, then I would certainly recommend edibles as opposed to smoking anything. Smoking anything is going to give you cancer. But certainly, I have a lot of patients who are smoking, who are colleagues and everything, who are actually using this time, since they're not going to be able to get out to the store to get cigarettes, to work on actually just quitting smoking. Obviously, smoking also, this is a disease. This virus is a disease that attacks your lungs. People who have trouble with lung function because of smoking are at higher risk for death. So the number one thing you can do for your health and for fertility is to quit smoking.
Does smoking anything also impact sperm quality?
So smoking can certainly affect sperm quality. We were talking about DNA fragmentation with a listener question, and it can cause potential damage to sperm. So I certainly would recommend also, if your partner is smoking around you, the secondhand smoke can be harmful. We know that women who smoke have half the chance of getting pregnant.
The next one is to avoid excessive alcohol and drug use.
So it's almost like one of these memes where people are like, the thing saying which wine tour are you going on? And there's a picture of somebody's house with like living room, family room, kitchen, and there's a glass of wine in each room, right? And I'll tell you, I have patients who work in the alcohol industry that are saying that people are just stocking up and they're bored, they're home, they're not driving anywhere, and they're drinking excessive amounts of alcohol. This is not going to help you get pregnant. It's going to make you maybe gain weight. So the recommendations for alcohol use. So we talk about alcohol equivalence. So that is 1 to 1.5 ounces of hard liquor. That is a 12-ounce can of beer or a 5 to 6 ounce glass of wine. So that is considered one alcoholic equivalent. For women, they should have no more than 2 in 24 hours. For men, no more than 3. And you should have none after ovulation. So I certainly would recommend, if you want to drink more than usual, that's fine. I would certainly recommend staying in the guidelines. And if you can avoid it, it'll just help you prepare your body for pregnancy.
The next tip is to avoid certain medications. Which ones do you recommend avoiding and why?
Obviously, there's some things that we talked about. Elderberry, you potentially could worsen. There's a cytokine response that people can get very, very sick from. And the elderberry worsens that. They're also finding that NSAIDs, so Advil, Aleve, ibuprofen, naproxen, aspirin, can also worsen that. So if you think you may have COVID, and obviously this is not a virus we've known about for more than 3 months, so this is all very limited data that we're getting, and it's not the most reliable data, but the current recommendations are not to have NSAIDs if you think you may have COVID. Instead, just take Tylenol.
The next one is to take fertility improving supplements. Tell us about those.
So certainly I would recommend you talk to your doctor before taking any supplements, but you don't know how they'll interact with the virus or the other medications you're taking. For men who have sperm issues, or for women who may have issues with egg quality or diminished ovarian reserve, CoQ10, I usually recommend 400 for men and 600 for women, is a pretty easy medication to take. So that is one thing that you can take during this time to sort of help with egg quality.
The next one is limit exposure to environmental toxins. Tell us about that.
So certainly some of us are in jobs that we're exposed to toxins. Hopefully most of us are trying to stay away from jobs at the moment. I think also in terms of toxins, looking at food, it's really hard right now, but obviously avoiding food with dyes or chemicals, processed foods is the best. And listen, we're right now in a crisis where you kind of just have to do your best.
The next one is probably going to be a hard one, but reduce stress and improve overall emotional well-being.
So I certainly would recommend people work on stress management and either try some home yoga, or I'm a big fan of meditation. So there's a couple of apps out there for fertility called FertiCalm and Ferti Strong for men and women. And there's also the Calm app, C-A-L-M. There are some free meditations on there. We use it all the time, so we have a paid membership. But listening to a meditation is really helpful. And studies have shown it also changes the brain chemistry so that it can really, really reduce stress. And so obviously this is an incredibly stressful time. And I think people are worried for their health. They're worried for their loved ones. They're worried financially. They're worried because they're having to delay treatment. So doing anything you can to improve emotional well-being is going to be really helpful.
What about avoiding the news, or at least not watching it 24/7?
Yeah, so I certainly think that it's important to take a break from the news. Sometimes it's easy to get sucked in and want to be in this information gathering phase. And if you can give yourself a break, then it can also help manage stress and expectations from both the news as well as social media.
The next tip is to have lots of sex. Tell us about that.
So sex obviously is a way to help get pregnant if you have a partner of the opposite gender, of course. Sex also, especially orgasms, are helpful in terms of stress relief. When we have prolactin and oxytocin released from intercourse, it's sort of the love hormones, and people kind of have a sense of calm and connection. Having a good connection with your spouse during this difficult time is really important. So I would say if you're stuck home together, have lots of sex, maybe you'll get pregnant. And it also can help with stress management.
The last tip that I had before you can take over and add anything else that you'd like to is to register for the free Beat Infertility Virtual Summit, which you are speaking in.
Yes. What an amazing opportunity. And thank goodness you did it virtually and not in person, because otherwise it would have been canceled. But what an amazing opportunity for people to learn about a ton of different topics from experts in the field.
To register, listeners can go to beatinfertility.co/summit. It will be airing over National Infertility Awareness Week in April. And as of right now, there are more than 60 speakers. So this is a great way to keep yourself educated on the latest and greatest in reproductive medicine.
Yes. So one of the other things I really talk to my patients about, and I've did some TikTok videos and Instagram stuff on this as well, is I think there are sort of top 12 things to help with stress. So I want to go through those. One is work on coloring books or puzzles, those adult coloring books that can be really stress relieving. Two, we talked about home yoga and doing exercising. Three is sex. We talked about that one. Four is take a break from social media and the news. Even a few hours is helpful sometimes. Number five is take a hot shower. I would avoid hot baths if you could be pregnant, or if you're a man, you should not be taking hot baths, but hot showers are just fine. Take a walk and get your eyes in some sunshine. That can be really helpful from an emotional perspective. Number seven is meditate. We talked about the FertiCalm, FertiStrong, and the Calm apps. The eighth is connecting with friends and family through Skype and FaceTime to try to prevent yourself from being socially isolated. Number nine is sleep, which we talked about. Number 10 is to write a snail mail letter to a relative or friend, maybe a grandparent or elderly relative who may not have access to the internet. Number 11 is, and I got a meme that said something like, at 9 p.m. is when you change from your daytime pajamas to your evening pajamas. And I really would have encourage everyone who's stuck at home right now to get up, get dressed, do your hair, put your makeup on, and have a regular routine to your day. And then the most important thing, number 12, is gratitude. Sometimes it feels overwhelming and that our world has been turned upside down, and it's really unsettling, of course. It's important to think about things you're grateful, and not just like I have shelter, but like really specific things, right? I'm grateful that my husband helps me with cleaning up the house and taking out the trash. Or I'm grateful that my work has allowed me to work from home. not my work because I'm not working from home, but you know, it's something you could say to yourself. I'm grateful that the sun is shining and I'm starting to see birds singing and blossoms of flowers coming up. That's really something I'm grateful for. I'm grateful that I have enough food right now. So it's really important every day to remind yourself of the things we're grateful for, because it's easy to get trapped in a cycle of not feeling well and feeling like the world is crashing in on you. And if you can be grateful to the things around you, you will feel better.
I admittedly have no idea what TikTok is, even after Googling it, but I've seen it a lot in my Facebook feed from you. I have a hard time keeping up with it, actually. How can people follow you? I don't even know if that's the proper terminology.
Okay. I will tell you. So TikTok is a social media platform that I think is really, really popular with people in their teens and 20s, although there's lots of people in their 30s, 40s, and beyond who are on it. It is short videos, 15 to 60 second videos that, and you can follow certain people. So if you sign up for TikTok, I actually really enjoy it. And it's kind of just like all social media. Sometimes it can suck you in a little bit, but I find it really fun. There's some like memes that go around TikTok. So certain songs and they'll do some dances and stuff. I don't do a whole lot of dancing, but there's a lot of doctors on TikTok, a lot of fertility doctors on TikTok giving some good information. I do also a show with my daughter called Teen Talk. So where we talk about gynecologic issues that may be affecting teens and 60 second question snippets. It's at dr.allison.rogers, which is the same as my Instagram. But yeah, there's a little bit of a different, more people on there are maybe a little bit younger, but I will tell you, I'm 42 and I enjoy it. So there's a lot of cute animal videos. And, you know, in a day and age where so much is so serious, sometimes watching some stupid stuff can be helpful.
Do you think that for the infertility warriors who are suddenly stuck at home and have never worked from home before, do you think that isolation is even more harmful for them?
I think that it's harmful for everybody, right? Like, I think that being not in your routine, not seeing people, not celebrating holidays or birthdays or weddings or funerals even, I think that's really difficult. And that's why I think connecting with people, not necessarily through social media, but connecting with people like FaceTiming, phone calls, writing letters can be really helpful for everybody. I will tell you that I've had FaceTimes and phone calls with people I don't usually, and it's everybody needs it right now. Literally, the whole world is needing to talk and connect in different ways. And so I think that it's certainly something I would encourage people to sort of reach out to those around you, because really, we're all in this together. We really are.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to the vast amount of information we've already talked about?
Well, I will say that I think that a lot of fertility doctors out there are trying to help be able to move forward with treatment as soon as possible and help that this sort of break is as short as possible. And I'm certainly hoping by the time this even airs, those decisions are reversed, because obviously fertility is a disease, and waiting and not moving forward with treatment is something that is not beneficial for patients and maybe the difference between for some patients success and not being successful using their own eggs. And so I think that this is certainly something that the fertility doctors are trying to fight really hard for their patients behind the scenes in terms of petitioning. There's a couple different petitions going around right now, and certainly some doctors don't feel comfortable signing it, and a lot of doctors are. So I think from a fertility doctor perspective, you need to know that the doctors are really trying to fight hard for your right to treatment.
To wrap up the episode, what words of hope would you offer to patients who are on a break from fertility treatments right now?
So remember, you can't do anything about this situation, but we can do something about the way we're thinking about it. And instead of saying this time was stolen from me, if you change your thinking and say, what can I do to prepare my body for pregnancy so that when I can move forward, I'm as ready as possible? That is the healthiest way to think about it.
Dr. Rogers, thank you so much as always.
Thanks, Heather.
Again, if you have a fertility question you'd like Dr. Rogers to answer in an upcoming episode, go to beatinfertility.co/ask.
Thank you for listening to Beat Infertility. Join our free private support community at beatinfertility.co/app. If you find yourself needing additional support, visit our paid programs at beatinfertility.co www.hopeyou.com/hopeyou. If you'd like your story to be considered for a future episode, please fill out the form at beatinfertility.co/contact. Until next time.